Thank you, Josh. Appreciate it. How you doing, everybody? I am Matt Cassidy. I'm a grateful recovered alcoholic.
Hey,
And
Matt.
yeah, it's always a pleasure and an honor to be able to speak at a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. I mean, to carry a message of how God took a helpless, hopeless human being and, was pretty much on a downward spiral, and was able to pick him up and lift him up and raise him up to a life beyond, beyond anything he ever thought possible. You know, I definitely have a life today that is filled with God's grace. I mean, I love the name of this group. I love, the name Grace so much that when it came time to pick my daughter's middle name, it was between faith, grace, or hope, and grace won out, because we like the initial G, it matched my son's middle initial, but grace was definitely, is one of the top three. So we picked that one, yeah, I planned on sharing, what it says in, how it works, what I was like, what happened, and what I'm like now. But I figured I would kind of tie that in a little bit more to what it says on page 29, that each individual in his personal stories describes in his own language and from his own point of view, the way he established his relationship with God. So I'm going to talk about three things tonight, three of my favorite topics. The first one being myself, the second one being the steps, the third one being the God of my understanding today that I have a relationship with. I also want to tie it into, I was listening to a speaker tape of Myers Raymer. He spoke at the Fellowship of the Spirit in Toronto, and he quoted an old speaker named Don Pritz, and his quote resonated with me so much that I wanted to tie it into my talk tonight. Myers, quoting Don, said, "I'm a little caught off guard by how over the years we've moved away from conversations about recovery and settled for sobriety." When I heard that, it definitely resonated with the type of Alcoholics Anonymous meetings that are in my area. It's a lot of fellowship-based stuff. Don't drink, go to meetings, 90 meetings, 90 days, meeting makers make it. If you're feeling bad, double up on your meetings, make sure you share how you feel, cut that problem in half, and a whole bunch of other slogans that, for the real alcoholic, are not going to save your life, and they measure sobriety time, how long you've been sober, much more, than a message of recovery. My sobriety date is May the 5th of 1996. Like Josh said, I did get sober on Cinco de Mayo. And yes, that is a longstanding promise. It's been 24 years and still running. If I ever do meet the Mexican who got sober on St. Patrick's Day, him and I will start a big book study. I guess it could be, Matt and Juan, a big book study. We'll see what happens. I do want to talk about, the difference between recovery, recovery from alcoholism being, freedom from alcoholism, what it talks about on the cover page. I mean, the book starts off with, my second sponsor pointed out that it said, the full title of the book, Alcoholics Anonymous, the story of how many thousands of men and women have recovered from alcoholism. He was the first person who pointed out to me that I could get well from this disease. And it went very contradictory to what I heard in a lot of meetings. They were saying stuff like, you'd always be recovering. You were never going to get well. You were always going to be sick. And that message did not resonate with me of one of hope. So when they said the speaker was going to share their experience, strength, and hope, the fact that I would always be sick, did not bring any type of hope to me. So when my sponsor showed me that I could be recovered from alcoholism, that recovery would equal freedom, that was much more, enticing, There's a big difference between freedom from alcoholism and relief from alcoholism. That same sponsor who showed me that cover page also showed me in, the doctor's opinion where it talks about if the alcoholic, abstains from drinking, then the phenomenon of craving cannot be triggered. So the phenomenon of craving is only part of my illness. If I'm not drinking alcohol, if I'm sitting in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous just not drinking alcohol, and I have physical sobriety, only part of my disease is being treated, and it's not even treatment, okay? It's just relief. It says I have relief from the physical allergy. That same sponsor gave me the analogy of if you take a prisoner, so you have a prisoner sitting in a 6x8 jail cell. He's definitely a prisoner. He's got small cell that he's stuck in. You take that prisoner and you put him out in the courtyard, so during his yard time, he's still a prisoner. Okay, he's still a member of that prison. So he has relief from his jail cell, but he doesn't have freedom yet. You take that prisoner and you put him on the other side of the prison walls, which you now have as a free man. So what I shoot for, is not just only physical sobriety. I shoot from recovery from alcoholism so that I can walk around a free man today, so that I could say I've recovered from a seemingly hopeless state of mind and body, which is what the founders of this fellowship, wanted for all of us. So if you haven't related to me yet, you know, I've either probably done one of two things, either rub you the wrong way. And if that be the case, you know, feel free to put me on your resentment inventory, but don't forget to put Josh, because, you know, he's the one who invited me here. So, you know, he should definitely get second billing, you know, or you're related to me and I'm kind of preaching to the choir. And if that be the case, then you're my type of alcoholic, and, you know, and we can become lifelong friends. You know, the one thing that came out of this whole Zoom platform is, you know, the I got friends now in Canada. I got friends in Mississippi, I can say now. I got friends in Washington. I got, you know, I got friends, you know, in Massachusetts. I got friends all over the United States today, you know, as a result of these Zoom meetings. I got friends in California. You know, I got friends in North Carolina. You know, and then the list just goes on and on. I'm looking at some of these names on the list, and it's like, yeah, I remember that meeting that I met them in, and, you know, that we've had some good times on Saturday mornings with those people. You know, so I can definitely look at some of the names on the list and think, you know, think of how, you know, God has made our paths cross, you know, how we've touched each other's lives and how, you know I'm truly blessed for it. You know, so, but just kind of a little bit, you know, just to qualify, you know, myself as an alcoholic, so you can know why I'm speaking at an Alcoholics Anonymous meeting. I was born into alcoholism. My father is still an active alcoholic. You know, in my family, you know, I'm Irish on both sides of the fence. My mom's Irish, my dad's Irish. And, you know, therefore in my family, if you're not alcoholic, you marry one just to fit in. And, you know, the people usually get a laugh at that one, but unfortunately it's the truth. I have an uncle who died of cirrhosis of the liver about 2 years ago. But when they talk about him, they say he died of an infection. You know, he died of cirrhosis of the liver, jaundice. Okay. You know, those are, you know, definite symptoms of alcoholism, but we can't talk about that because then we'd have to talk about the elephant in the room. I got another uncle who's bouncing in and out of sober houses because he can't stay sober, you know, but we don't talk about him at all, because if we did, then we would have to talk about alcoholism, you know, but we don't talk about that elephant in the room. You know, I belong to a family that likes to live in delusion when it comes to alcoholism. You know, it's normal behavior. You know, if I did not belong to that family, then my alcoholism and my alcoholic behavior probably would have stuck out, you know, any worse than it did. But because of the family I grew up in and because of the family I was raised in, you know, my behavior was completely acceptable. So when I did stuff like, you know, get really drunk and make an ass out of myself, it was not, you know, we think you have a drinking problem. Instead, it was, we think you drank a little too much last night. You need to watch yourself, you know, going forward. So my, you know, a lot of my unacceptable behavior was accepted, you know, so it prolonged my drinking a lot longer than it should have. You know, I got sober at 19 years of age, you know, and I was sitting in rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I heard, you know, speakers from the podium talking about, you know, DWIs and divorces and losing careers and losing houses and losing custody battles. And I couldn't relate to any of that stuff. And, you know, and they're all sharing from the podium that this is what alcoholism is. And so I'm sitting in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous wondering if I'm even an alcoholic. And thanks to good sponsorship and thanks for the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous, it spells out quite clearly on page 44 that if, when you honestly want to, you find you cannot quit entirely, you know, so do I have choice over whether I'm going to drink or not? Or if when drinking, you have little control over the amount you take, so do I have control once I start drinking? You are probably alcoholic. The book never tells me that I'm alcoholic, but it does give me lots of descriptions of what an alcoholic is. And if I could identify with those, you know, then I can put two and two together and figure out that I'm an alcoholic. And if it tells me, if that be the case, then you may be suffering from an illness which only a spiritual experience will conquer. So it doesn't leave much room for what I need to do to get well. You know, that I have to have a spiritual experience. You know, due to good sponsorship, you know, my sponsor did qualify me by those two questions. You know, he had me look at my drinking career, and that should be the first, you know, red flag. If you have a drinking career, you know, then chances are you may be alcoholic, because normal people don't look at this as a career path. You know, they look at it as, you know, 9 out of 10 people can drink social, but they drink normal. You know, I'm married to one of those non-alcoholics, and she does crazy things like drink for taste. You know, she'll order a drink and take a sip of it. If she doesn't like it, she won't finish it. You know, her glass does really weird things like sweat. You know, I can't relate to that. You know, her, if she puts, if there's ice in her drink, it actually melts. I mean, you know, the woman is just, you know, she's just beyond illogical when it comes to drinking, but I love her anyway. You know, so, you know, normal people like that can't answer those two, you know, cannot identify with those two things. You know, so my sponsor qualified me, you know, do I have mental obsession? You know, mental obsession showed up, you know, on my last drunk. You know, my last drunk was what it took to get me convinced that I'm an alcoholic, because even sitting in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous, I heard lots of people talking about the physical allergy. After I drink too much, you know, so I could relate to all that stuff, you know, but nobody was talking about the mental obsession. So when I was looking at physical allergy, I could definitely relate to that. But I have other physical allergies, you know, in my life. I have a physical allergy when it comes to strawberries. When I drink strawberries, I break out in hives. See, the difference between my alcoholism and my strawberries is that I can make a decision not to eat strawberries and it will stick. You know, the fear of breaking out in hives can stop me from eating strawberries. The desire to not, you know, to not break out in hives again can stop me from eating strawberries. You know, so when people want to go strawberry picking, I kindly say I pass, and you know, because I don't want to have that reaction. But when it comes to my alcoholism, you know, the physical allergy isn't, you know, just isn't enough. You know, I, well, you know, one story that, you know, that, you know, that kind of shows physical allergy, you know, the talks about in a doctor's opinion that when I start drinking, I don't drink to escape. I drink to overcome, you know, a, you know, I'm drinking to overcome a craving that's beyond my mental control, meaning I can't use my mind, to solve, you know, not drinking so much. You know, you know, I was working with a girl one time and I wanted to impress her, and everybody after work was going out to the bar. At the time, I was only 19 years of age. You know, so I had asked my mom, could I borrow my aunt's car? You know, we had a possession of my aunt's car because my aunt was recuperating from, you know, a bout with breast cancer. You know, so she was at home, you know, getting well, you know, recovering from breast cancer. And she gave us our car, her car, because she wanted us to take care of it. You know, so I begged my and pleaded with my mom, because it was a really nice sports car. Could I borrow the sports car to impress this girl? You know, I swore up and down, and I meant every word of it. I was like, I can't even drink. I'm going to the bar, but I can't drink, you know, because I'm underage. They're not going to serve me, you know. So I got the car. You know, I probably got the car just, you know, because I was probably irritating enough. It was like, you know, it's probably, you know, if I give him the car, he'll shut up, you know, which is probably the main reason why I got the car, you know. So I did get the car. I did pick up the girl trying to impress her. But when I got to the bar, you know, they started buying me drinks and, you know, sneaking into me on the back porch, you know. So once I did start drinking, you know, along comes that phenomenon of craving that I know develops, you know, so that one drink leads to two, and two leads to a whole lot more, you know. So the promise to not drink and drive that night does not stick. You know, the desire to not wreck a car, the want to not get arrested, you know, the want to, you know, stay sober and try and impress somebody just doesn't stick around as soon as I put one drink in my body. So that physical allergy to definitely relate to. But when it was pointed out to me that the mental obsession, that the main problem centers in the mind, you know, my inability to not stay sober. You know, I stopped drinking lots of times before I came to Alcoholics Anonymous, but what happened was I couldn't stay sober. You know, I would just keep going back to the drink, and I didn't know why until, you know, the mental obsession was explained to me. You know, my last drunk, like I said, is what finally convinced me, because when I had a clear look at it, I had a moment of clarity after that night of drinking. I made a promise to myself that night I wasn't going to drink, you know, and I meant it. You know, if you gave me a lie detector test, I would have passed it, and I would have meant every single word that I'm not going to drink tonight. But when I'm driving to this party about 45 minutes later, my mind sells me a lie. And it's another thing I hear in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous that I can't relate to: play the tape all the way through, keep it green. And, you know, if I could do that stuff, then I wouldn't have to come to Alcoholics Anonymous. But what happened to me was this lie just came out of right field, jumps right in the forefront of my brain. That if I buy a six pack for a 6 hour party, I can drink one beer an hour, and that's social drinking. So I can drink, and they will have to leave me alone that I'm alcoholic, because I can prove to them that I can drink normally. You know, so I bought into that lie. And of course, you know, you all know how the story ends. I had one drink led to two drinks led to a hell of a lot more, and a whole hell of a lot more usually leads to incomprehensible demoralization. You know, so I can definitely relate to that part in a big book where it says, you know, where it talks about that, because, you know, a lot of embarrassing things happened to me as a result of my drinking, but that embarrassment, you know, does not keep me sober. That embarrassment the following morning, what it does is it gives me more reason of a drink, because if I drink, that feeling of shame and guilt goes away. You know, so it was a never ending, circle, of alcoholism. You know, I can also relate to in a book where it talks about the Jekyll and Hyde. You know, I was thinking about this earlier today. You know, I worked in a receiving department before I got sober. And if you've ever worked in a receiving department, if you know anybody who does it, it's loading and unloading trucks. So it's a pretty dirty job. So I would go to work every day. You know, I'd sweat up a storm. I'd get covered in dirt, you know, so I would come home from work dirty. But at the time, I was also taking some college classes. So I would come home from work, I would shower, and then I would put on a tie and a college shirt. So just to go to class, so the people would, you know, would see this, I could present this exterior that I had life all together, you know. And at the whole time, I didn't want anybody to know the real me, because if you knew the real me, then I wouldn't, you know, that I would not definitely be not accepted, you know. So I could definitely relate to, you know, those feelings also. You know, you fast forward to that last drunk. When I woke up the morning after my last drunk, when I woke up on the morning of May the 5th, 1996, what happened to me was I had a moment of clarity. I had that God-given moment where I could see the truth as the truth. You know, that truth, you know, showed itself as what happened to not wanting to drink. Why is it, Matt, that when you say you don't want to drink, you find yourself drinking anyway? I didn't have an answer yet because I didn't have a big book, but what I did have was this vision, you know, of what my drinking looks like, and it was different from everybody else. You know, like I said, I did come to Alcoholics Anonymous as a result of that moment of clarity, you know, because the, you know, my mom went to Al-Anon when I was 7 years old. You know, shortly before my 8th birthday, my mom joined Al-Anon. You know, so I did have exposure to a 12-step fellowship. I knew about alcoholism, you know, I knew about blackouts before I had one. You know, so when I had my first blackout, that should have been a red flag. But of course, red flags don't get us sober. You know, all it was just another reason. It's like, I knew I had one. I knew what it was, but I hope nobody finds out that I had it, you know, because, you know, then I'll have to try and explain, you know, why it is and try and rationalize how it's normal. You know, so I knew about alcoholism. I knew about 12 steps. And there was a person in my life at the time who, he was the first alcoholic I met. He was in AA and he was almost 5 years sober. So he was the first person that I ever met. You know, because like I said, everybody in my family is active alcoholics. So my idea of alcoholism is if you get it, you got it, you suffer from it. You know, and this guy, you know, came across my life. God put him in my life and he was almost 5 years sober at the time. So what I saw is that you can get well from alcoholism. You know, so I wanted what he had. You know, so I came, you know, I started going to meetings that he was going to. But unfortunately, those meetings, like I said, were fellowship-based meetings. So I spent the first 100 days of my sobriety, you know, at meetings, you know, where there was no message of depth and weight. You know, so as a result, I'm sitting in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous dying of untreated alcoholism, you know, and not knowing it because I'm surrounded by people who are telling me, as long as you didn't drink today, you're a winner. You know, it doesn't matter what I did. You know, I could have gotten a fight with my girlfriend. I could have yelled at my parents. I could have drove like a maniac. I could have gotten into it with my boss, you know, and regardless of what happened in my life, they're like, hey, you're a winner as long as you're just not drinking. That's not what my big book says. You know, my big book talks about, you know, forming a relationship with that God and my understanding and becoming a spiritual being and becoming, you know, who God wants me to be, which is not somebody who acts like that. You know, if I act like that, you know, it's definitely time for a 10-step or 11-step action, you know, because I do have a program of action today where when those things do rear their ugly heads, I have a way to get out of it. But so I find myself in North Carolina and all of a sudden I find myself surrounded by people who are carrying big books. Even when it's not a big book meeting, they have big books with them. You know, when they share, you know, they share a big book message. You know, they share straight, you know, they're talking a strange language. They're talking about a prayer meditation life. They're talking about a relationship with a higher power. They're talking about, you know, how they know every, you know, even amongst, you know, the storm, they know they can stay calm. You know, even when bad things are happening, they're okay with it. You know, these were all strange concepts to me because, you know, again, in fellowship sobriety was teaching me that it's a one day at a time program. And what I thought one day at a time meant was when you have a problem, you need to figure out the solution within 24 hours, otherwise you're going to drink, you know? So, and if you're having a problem, you know, then you should go to the meeting and you should share. And if that doesn't take care of it, then your answer is double up on your meetings because, you know, then that'll help you out. And it was just, again, it was stuff that does not, you know, does not equal recovery. You know, it equals relief, you know? So in North Carolina is where I met that sponsor who introduced me to the big book. He did show me, you know, where it says where I can be recovered from alcoholism, you know, on the title page, thousands of men and women who have recovered from alcoholism. You know, it says on, you know, the first page, we looked at the forward to the first edition. We of Alcoholics Anonymous are more than 100 men and women who have recovered from a seemingly hopeless state of mind and body. To show other alcoholics precisely how we have recovered is the main purpose of this book. So I'm three sentences into the book and they've already said it's recovered three times. You know, so I'm all jazzed up on what this guy's talking about. And then, like I said, he qualifies me with those two questions and then points out that I have to have a spiritual experience. You know, when I first came into Alcoholics Anonymous, me and God were not, you know, we did not get along. And it was all my doing because what I had is I had years of preconceived, you know, notions on what God was and the way he showed up in my life. You know, like I said, I grew up in an alcoholic household. My dad was physically abusive. My dad was verbally abusive. You know, I did get sexually abused by an ex-door neighbor when I was 8 years old. So all of these life experiences, what it taught me is that if there was, and I was 8 years old when I made the decision that if there was a God, I didn't want to have anything to do with him. So now I'm 20 years of age in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I'm being told I need to have a relationship with this God. And I was a little closed-minded to the idea, and I was told it's okay to be closed-minded. You know, there's a chapter for people like you called we agnostics. So Matt, he walked me through the first step, on our first meeting. He got me to admit I was powerless over alcohol and that my life was unmanageable. And the unmanageability was not the drama that went on in my life as a result of my drinking. The unmanageability of my life was my internal condition. The restless, irritable, and discontent that I am sober, that the doctor's opinion tells me is what makes me drink, because when I drink, I get a sense of ease and comfort. And those drinks I see others take with impunity. So he pointed out to me that, I definitely, could I identify with the first step? Yes, I can. Okay, then there's no choice but to move on to the second step, because Matt, if lack of power is your problem, then you need a power greater than yourself. And he showed me the chapter, We Agnostics, and he said that was my, my homework assignment from him was, we were going to get together once a week, to work the steps, so once a week we get together, my job was to come prepared. If I wasn't ready, to discuss that step, then there was nothing to talk about, so my job, my homework assignment for step two was to read step two out of the 12 and 12 every night, and to read, to read We Agnostics every day for a week, and then get together and see if we had an open mind. And it didn't take, God longer than a week to show up in my life. I was telling the story last night because I was at a men's spiritual meeting, and the whole topic was about God. So the whole meeting was a pep rally for God. And I shared, the following story. It was, I was probably about, 120 days sober, I was sitting on a lawn, on my college campus, and there's a fountain at the center of campus where everybody goes to hang out. So I was sitting at the fountain and I had my big book with me and I'm reading We Agnostics, because I still have a closed mind to God, but I'm doing what I'm supposed to do to get an open mind. And I get to page 54, and it says, had we not variously worshiped people, sentiments, things, money, and ourselves, and then with a better motive, had we not worshipfully beheld the sunset, the sea, or a flower, who of us had not loved something or somebody? How much did these feelings, these loves, these worships have to do with pure reason? And when I read that, I could totally relate to what Bill Wilson talked about. I had a near, white light experience like Bill talks about, because what happened to me when I read that is all of a sudden every ounce, of resistance to God just melted away at that moment. And what happened for me was all of a sudden the sunlight felt a little bit brighter. It felt a little bit warmer on me. I felt like a breeze, blow on by, and it was a nice cool breeze on a hot day. It was just like, and I just felt the presence of God in my life for the first time. And it was the highest I ever felt in my life. It was the most loved I ever felt in my life. And I remember I started to get, misty eyed, and I was like, I have to tell my sponsor. And I ran to the phone and through a veil of tears, I explained to my sponsor what happened. And he said, Matt, you've just had a second, and it sounds like a third step experience. He said, the next step is to turn your will and your life over to the care of God as you understood him. And he explained to me that he goes, Matt, take a look at the condition of your life when you showed up into the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous. He goes, the God that you've just met, do you think that he could screw up your life any more than you have to date? And I had to concede to him that that was a true point. My life run on my willpower was hardly a success, is what it says in the book, so I could not run the show anymore, because the best I could do got me in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous. The best I could do, got me, when we looked at the condition of my life, my parents were not fond of their middle child. My siblings were not in love, with their brother, but when I came into the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous, I was 19 years of age and had never even had a girlfriend, because I could never even get, past the first date. So my life, my scorecard read zero when I came to Alcoholics Anonymous, and that was all my doing. So could that God that I had just met, perhaps he could take me beyond, where I was. And I conceded that that was definitely something that could happen, so that was my experience with the third step. Today, my third, today when I work with guys, I explain the third step to them in the, in the following, example. I says, because it says in the third step that we turn our will and our lives over to the care of God as we understood him. Due to God's grace today and God's wonderful plan for me, I do have two kids. I have a 9-year-old son and a 4-year-old daughter. So if I want to go out with my wife on a date, we got to get a babysitter, so I can hire a babysitter to come and take care of my kids. But as long as I'm in the house, even if I'm in a different room, the babysitter goes to correct my kids' behavior, or she goes to play with a game with them, or she goes to do something with them, you know, as long as I'm in the house, she's not taking care of them because I'm still there. I can stick my nose in the room and put my two cents in. No, don't let him play that game. You know, no, he's not allowed to have his iPad because he's in trouble. You know, so I can still get my two cents in. So as long as I'm in the picture, I can still run the show. You know, it says in the third step that we can at last abandon ourselves to God. And it was explained to me that, you know, to abandon is to leave something behind without any more regard for it. You know, I would never leave, you know, I was given the example of a broken car. If I have a broken down car, am I going to abandon it because it no longer works? Or am I going to try and tinker with it and get a few more miles out of it? Because that would be my will. So to turn my will and my life over to the care of God, as I understood him, means that I got to exit the picture 100%. You know, my current sponsor explains to me that the third step boils down to one sentence. What I want does not matter. You know, so it's what God wants for me today. You know, so when things go wrong, you know, it's a chance for me to see, you know, just how powerful my God is. You know, I don't have a lot of problems today. What I have is I have a lot of circumstances that I can't wait to see the outcome of. You know, and I don't always take them gracefully. You know, I'm not perfect at this deal. That's for sure. So when Mark said, you know, we claim spiritual progress, I'm a whole hell of a lot better than I was when I showed up. You know, but I'm nowhere near perfect. I fall short every day. My feet are definitely still made out of clay. You know, I'm not a spiritual giant when it comes to this deal. You know, so that brought us to the fourth step, you know, and on the fourth step inventory, you know, it says in how it works that some of these we balked. I definitely balked at the fourth step, because what I saw was, you know, I was going to put pen to paper as a written confession. So in my eyes, you know, when you put stuff in your own handwriting, it's going to make it real. And I still wanted to see if I could skirt some of those things. So I kind of hesitated on, you know, writing an inventory at first, you know, but it was explained to me, you know, I was brought back to that, you know, to that part where it says, you know, the only way out of my alcoholism, and we agnostics says, is a spiritual experience. You know, that same sponsor pointed out to me that the spiritual experience that I need is guaranteed to me as the result of the 12 steps. So it says in the 12th step, having had a spiritual awakening as the result of these steps. So I will get the thing I need, but only as a result of working all 12 steps. So I can't balk on the fourth step and expect to get well sitting in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, I had to write that inventory. You know, one of the first things that made my inventory, you know, and I said to my sponsor at the time, I remember calling him up again, you know, through a veil of tears and crying with something that I never did before I got sober. I've cried buckets of tears since I got sober, but, you know, the ability to control my emotions, you know, beyond hate, you know, was something that I can do, you know, when I was drinking. So I remember calling him up. And again, it was the first time in my life, you know, that past abuse, you know, from the next door neighbor popped into my head. And when we got to that column about where was my, you know, where was I at fault? What was my mistake in the matter? You know, I want to know, you know, explain to me how that's an 8-year-old kid's fault. You know, how is it that, you know, that I played a part in that? You know, how is it that I deserve that? And he explained to me that, no, there are things in life that you're not at fault for. But what you are at fault for, Matt, is that you've been carrying that around for almost 15 years and you've never told anybody about it and you've never gotten over it. You know, so you're still carrying around the emotional baggage of it, but you can get well from it. You can get on the other side of that. You know, so, you know, he definitely steered me in the right direction on a whole bunch of areas of my life. You know, we moved on to the fifth step. You know, he asked me, it's my first fifth step, where would you like to do it? My answer was in my apartment. The whole reason why I answered my apartment, because I figured, you know, I had this written stuff in black and white, you know, and if I share it with him, then the worst he can do is just walk out on me. He can't throw me out of my own apartment. So therefore, you know, so I picked my apartment as the place to do it. And he came over. And what, you know, so I admitted to God, to myself, and to another human being. You know, it turns out God was in the room, that loving and caring God that I had discovered back in that second step. He showed up, you know, to show me that it was okay for all those things that I did. I didn't have to feel any guilt, shame, or remorse over any of that. It was okay because all I was doing the best I could with the tools I had at the time. You know, that same sponsor who I thought was going to, you know, be disgusted with me, and leave, you know, wound up, you know, being open, you know, open with me about some of the stuff he did. And it was, you know, it was the first time in my life I had, you know, 100% transparency with another human being, let alone transparency with another man. You know, and what happened that night is that, you know, I started the first time in my life to feel a closeness with, you know, male members of Alcoholics Anonymous, you know, and being able to experience, you know, the love that can happen between people, you know. So he explained to me that would bring us to six and seven. You know, six, you know, just being a quiet hour, you know. So I sat in quiet for an hour, you know, to contemplate, were my stones in place, you know, what, you know, was, uh, you know, was everything in order? If I can answer, you know, yes to two questions, and I move on, say the seventh step prayer, you know, that brought me to amends, you know, and the amends process is where, was where the real freedom came. You know, when I started making those amends, what happened was I was able to repair damaged relationships from the past. You know, it was explained to me that, you know, it's not a list of people that I'm going to go say I'm sorry to, because I'm sorry, you know, I had abused the words, I'm sorry, you know, by the time I got sober. They knew I was sorry. And if I was sorry, it meant nothing, because the behavior always continued. If I was going to amend means two things. One is to repair, you know, so I have to repair these damaged relationships, and I have to change, you know, the person that I was, you know, when I did the damage. You know, so I was able to make amends for a lot of my actions, my reactions, and my interactions with people. And those relationships were repaired, you know, and I could be the person that God wanted me to be. You know, I could be that son to my parents that, you know, that they deserve, you know, because they, you know, they did not deserve, you know, to be, you know, lay up at night, you know, wondering if their son, you know, what their son was and where he was doing, you know, where he was, what was going on. You know, so I make those amends, which brings me to, you know, 10, 11, and 12. And the thing that drives me nuts in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous is, you know, oh, these are the maintenance steps. You know, I don't want to maintain, you know, when I, you know, the person I was when I got to 10, 11, 12. I want to grow. You know, I want to continue to strengthen that relationship with God. You know, one of the things that my current sponsor had me working with during this coronavirus deal, you know, was, you know, with all the isolation, all the family time at home, you know, he had me working with, you know, in Bill's story. For if an alcoholic failed to perfect and enlarge his spiritual way of life through work and self-sacrifice for others, he could not survive the certain trials and low spots ahead. You know, I think everybody in the room could probably agree that everything that's going on, you know, in the country right now is definitely, a certain low spot. You know, there's a lot of stuff going on, you know, in a whole bunch of areas, you know, that are not a pretty picture. You know, there's a whole lot of stuff going on in the world today that I do not believe it's God's will. It's definitely a whole lot of human will going on. You know, so I want to continue to grow spiritually. So I continue to do 10, 11, and 12 to the best of my ability. You know, so the 10th step I can use throughout the day, you know, it tells me to watch, you know, so the first thing I got to do is I got to watch myself. You know, there's a buddy of mine, you know, we share the same sponsor, you know, I'll get a text from him out of the blue. It's like, hey man, are you on watch? And what that means is, am I looking out for selfishness, dishonesty, resentment, and fear? You know, it tells me when these crop up. So the funny thing about the 10th step is I'm supposed to be watching out for everything that I found out is disagreeable in the fourth step. Everything that showed up in the fourth column of my inventory still can crop up in my life today. When these crop up, so they are going to happen, I have to turn to God, that God of my understanding today, who, you know, I can have a relationship with. You know, so I can turn him and ask him to be removed. You know, so another thing that I hear in AA that drives me nuts is, oh, I'm working on my character defects. You know, if I'm working on my character defects, it's like being stuck in the mud and spinning my tires because I'm not going anywhere. I need God to remove these defects from me once I spot them. You know, so I ask God to remove them. Then it gives me the hardest part, discuss them with somebody at once. You know, discuss them with somebody immediately. You know, so to turn to another human being, and I got a buddy of mine in Kansas who's one of my best friends. He's one of my, you know, immediately's, you know, that I can call because I know he's non-judgmental. So when I call him and say, guess what I did again? You know, because a lot of the stuff that I do is, you know, it's happened again. You know, I know I shouldn't be doing it, but it happened again. You know, so I share it with him. I make amends, you know, when necessary. And then it tells me to turn my attention to somebody else that I can help. So my life today is supposed to be one of service. It's not supposed to be, you know, about how, you know, how I feel. You know, it's supposed to be about what am I doing for the next sick and suffering alcoholic. So I can work that 10th step throughout the day, you know, if I'm, you know, practicing a spiritual way of life. In the 11th step, it gives me direction on what to do in the morning. It gives me what direction to do at night. And it tells me what to do throughout the day. You know, I know yesterday I definitely fell short on the throughout the day where it tells me to pause when agitated or doubtful. If I don't have that moment of pause, then I react like, you know, I react crazy. You know, somebody cuts me off in traffic and I'm ready to ride the guy's bumper and, you know, let him know exactly how fumed I am, you know, with him, you know, so if I don't take that moment to pause, I can definitely act irrationally. I can definitely fly off the handle. You know, so I need to pause when agitated or doubtful. It tells me to ask for the right thought or action. If I bother to ask God for the right thought or action with that short, you know, with that short prayer, then what I'll get is the right answer. You know, don't say that. Don't react that way. The thing that you're about to say, keep it to yourself. Bite your tongue, you know. So it's like I can avoid a lot of 10th step work if I'm pausing and asking for that right thought or action, then following through. You know, the 12 step today is one of the joys of my life, you know, being able to help another sick and suffering alcoholic. When I came into AA, I was the world's biggest taker. You know, that sponsor who walked me through the steps introduced me to service work. You know, I made the mistake one day of telling him, you know, that I didn't feel a part of Alcoholics Anonymous. He pointed out to me that there was a young people's movement at the time and they were trying to start a conference. So he got me involved in setting up a conference, you know, so I had the joy and pleasure of participating in setting up a young people's conference, you know, in North Carolina. And they'll be celebrating, you know, if, unless, you know, unless COVID doesn't have its way, you know, they'll be celebrating their 24th conference, you know, this September, you know, but that's in North Carolina. So, you know, we'll see how, you know, the state of their affairs by then, you know, so, you know, so to be of service to, you know, be of maximum service to God and my fellows, you know, is something today that, you know, is a true honor and pleasure, you know, and it's something that I enjoy. It, you know, it says in the big book that you can become the highlight of your life. And that is definitely my experience, you know, with doing that stuff, you know, because I can get stuck into me, you know, poor, you know, what's going on in my life and how it's not what I want and how it's not going my way. And I can get stuck in, you know, I got a gold plated porcelain pity pot, you know, that I can sit on and, you know, and enjoy the comfort of it, you know, but if I do that, I can't be helping God. What I need to do is get back out on the firing lines. And the one thing that, you know, this whole COVID has done, you know, through Zoom, you know, it gives me, I'm no longer geographically confined to what meetings I want to go to. I can go anywhere, you know, at any time, and I can get out of myself. I can get out of my way just by, you know, sharing in a meeting about, you know, a little bit about what God has done for me in my life today, you know, and how, you know, how amazing it is. You know, the practice these principles in all my affairs is definitely one of the hardest things. You know, I always talk about, it's like, if I'm at a meeting and an alcoholic, a fellow member of Alcoholics Anonymous comes up to me and asks me, it's like, hey, can you drive me to a rehab, you know, to go help a guy that you don't even know, you know, and by the way, it's an hour and 45 minute drive. I'll be like, sure, let's get in the car, you know, and I'll pat myself on the back for being a spiritual giant and, you know, for carrying this message to another alcoholic. But if my wife calls me up and asks me to pick up milk on my way home from work, you know, if I don't pause when agitated or downfall, and if I'm in a bad mood, you know, I'll rip her head off, you know, and, you know, and so it's a, so I, like I said before, my feet are made of clay. I'm not perfect at this deal, you know, even at 24 years. And if I, you know, if I was perfect, you know, again, my buddy Derek always quotes his old sponsor. He says, you know, the bitch, you know, it's something along the lines of, you know, it's a bitch trying to be perfect when you're human, you know, because I'm always going to fall short, you know. So I try not to hold myself to higher, you know, to a higher plane than, you know, than I can, you know, that I can reach today. You know, my life today was an awesome day, you know, because, you know, again, you know, God's grace and, you know, God showing up in my life and, you know, the life I get to live today. Today was the 1 year anniversary of Wheels Down when my wife and I took a, you know, second honeymoon. You know, we flew, yeah, you know, a year ago today, we were Wheels Down in, you know, in the airport in Paris, France. You know, we went and visited Europe together. You know, we had a 10-day trip, you know, kid free, you know, where we could just get reacquainted, you know, me and my bride, you know, share some time together, you know, and have fun, you know, and have an experience together. You know, so I spent a lot of time, you know, in my parents' basement drinking, thinking about how good life could be if I ever got out of my parents' basement, you know, because, you know, they had a fully stocked bar and my dad made his own beer as a hobby. So, you know, so downstairs in the basement is where all the alcohol was. So that's why, you know, I spent a lot of time there. So I spent a lot of time, you know, wondering what life was like out of my parents' basement. But today I can live a life out, you know, outside, you know, outside of my house, outside of my four walls, you know, my parents' basement, the house that, you know, my parents owned, you know, when I got married, my wife and I bought that house, you know. So one of the coolest things about my life today is my name is on the mortgage of the house that I almost got thrown out of as a result of my drinking. You know, my son sleeps in my old bedroom that I used to drink in. You know, when I dropped out of college and came back home for a year, I turned, you know, my bedroom in my parents' house into a dorm room. You know, so what happened was I had a little refrigerator in the corner, and when I would get beer, I'd rotate the stock like a good beer distributor would do, you know, put the new stuff in the back to get cold and put cold stuff to the front, you know, so you can have that first. So I had a rotating stock in a fridge in my bedroom, you know, and like I said, this is my parents' house. So I had like no, you know, I used to smoke pot, you know, inside, you know, a bedroom of a house owned by a police lieutenant. So I just had no regard for anybody else, you know, when it came to, you know, anything that took me out of myself, you know. So, but my name is on that mortgage today, and we've been in that house, you know, for next month will be 16 years, you know, that we've owned together, you know, and we get to raise, you know, two beautiful children in that house. And, you know, they, like I said, you know, anybody who was here a little bit before the meeting, you saw my daughter coming, you know, give me a kiss goodnight, you know, so, you know, every night, you know, the kiss goodnight I get from her, you know, and, you know, for her to know that she's loved by her dad, you know, the is just. Just beyond anything that I ever thought possible, you know, because first of all, I couldn't even take care of myself when I got to Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, I was lucky if I took a shower within 48 hours, you know, of, you know, being presentable, you know, so I couldn't take care of myself, you know, when I got here. And God has given me two beautiful children to raise, you know, because he trusts me today with his kids. You know, I was raised in alcoholism. I was raised in active alcoholism. And with that comes, you know, all the baggage that comes with it. You know, it talks about it in the family afterwards. You know, the hurt feelings, the distrust. You know, the broken promises. You know, active alcoholism brings nothing good with it. You know, so that's what I was, you know, that's what I was raised in. And if it was not for the fellowship at the Al-Anon, if it wasn't for my mom, you know, working very diligently in that program, I probably would not have survived long enough to get to Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, because living with active alcoholism is never fun. You know, so my kids today get to grow up in alcoholism, but it's treated alcoholism. You know, so I get to kiss my daughter goodnight at night. You know, one of the things that we usually do, you know, she'll probably be, hopefully she'll be sleeping by the time I'm done with this talk. You know, so I won't be able to do it tonight, but what we normally do at night is, you know, we'll give each other a mooch, because we don't call it a kiss, we call it a mooch. So I get a mooch from my daughter, and then we'll give each other a big hug. And in case you need an education on what a big hug is, it's kind of like a normal hug, except you go, while doing it. So every night, my daughter and I give each, you know, we give each other a mooch, and then we give each other a big hug. So my four-year-old daughter knows, you know, that she's loved, you know, because when I, you know, when I came to Alcoholics Anonymous and they closed meetings with the Our Father, I equated it to my father, and it was not a pretty picture, you know. So I would say the Our Father, because I needed to fit in. I didn't want to look different then. So I would say the Our Father, but I would have this disdain, and I would have this distaste in my mouth when I would be saying it. You know, that's not the result. That's not, you know, that's because I would think of my earthly father. Today I know my heavenly father. I have a relationship with him. So I can say the Our Father, you know, with, you know, and it, you know, and it moves me. You know, my children today have a father that loves them. You know, when I tuck my son in at night, you know, he's 9 years old, so he has me check the closet to see if the boogeyman's in there. And when I, you know, when I confirm to him that the boogeyman's not in there, in the back of my head, what I really see is the empties that I used to keep in there. Because like I said, I had my beer distributor in my bedroom. So I used to have all my empties, you know, for the 5 cent recycling deposit, you know, so I used to keep them all so that I can, you know, get my money back, you know, from the bottles. You know, so I see I don't see the boogeyman in there, but what I do see is how great my life is today, that I don't have to live that way anymore. You know, and then I give my son a hug, and I ask my son every night before I tuck him into bed, I'm like, you know, Dad loves you, right? And there's nothing better than hearing my son say, yeah, I know, Dad, I love you too. You know, so that's the stuff that could not happen if I didn't come to Alcoholics Anonymous. That's the stuff that could not happen if I did not work these 12 steps. That's the stuff that could not happen if I didn't find the God of my understanding and form a relationship with him. Because if all I wanted to settle for was just not drinking one day at a time and being able to say, look, I've got a 24-year chip in my pocket. You know, I'd be no better than some of the, you know, I used to go to morning meetings, and there were people that had, like, you know, 28, 30 years sober. And they were some of the crankiest people you'd ever meet in your life. You know, I think if they smiled, it would probably hurt. You know, I mean, that's how bad they were. You know, so it's like, and these were the same people, because they had 30 years of sobriety. I'd walk in the room, and when it came my turn to share, you know, I'd introduce myself just like I did tonight. I'm Matt Cassidy. Why the hell is he sharing his last name? And I'm a recovered alcoholic. You know, so when it came their time to share, they'd lock eyes with me, and they'd be like, I'm so-and-so, and I'm a recovering alcoholic. You know, and I would just sit there, and I would take it, because God today wants, you know, if I got to sit in a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous, you know, and they can't relate to that recovered, you know, message that we can recover from this. It's not my job. I've resigned from the debating society. It's just my job to, you know, help save lives today. So I'll carry the message that I got to carry. You guys can carry your message, and we'll see what people find more attractive. You know, I care more today about, you know, saving people's lives than being liked, you know, in a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, what's most important to me is that newcomer. that person who's bouncing in and out. You know, God has a sense of humor, because most of the guys I want to sponsor are chronic relapsers. You know, they're the people who are met with meetings. It's like, well, you just didn't want it enough. That's why you didn't stay sober. It's like, maybe they weren't given the correct way to do it, which is why they didn't get well. Hey, it's like, I always ask the guys that I start working with, I'm like, are you done? Do you want to stop for good and for all? Because if you do, I have a way out. I can show it to you, and I know it works because I've done it. You know, it's not theory, it's proven experience. You know, so if that's the stuff, you know, that's creating the fellowship that I crave, that it talks about on page 164. You know, so I can surround myself today with people who, you know, like I said, you know, people like Josh, who it's like, if it wasn't for Zoom, I don't think I'd ever have a buddy in Mississippi. You know, but I do, you know, but I do today, you know, because we share that same desire, you know, to better Alcoholics Anonymous and to introduce more people to the power of God, and how if he shows up in their lives, you know, it can be better. You know, I'll end with this, because it always means so much to me. It's got a permanent place in my big book. You know, I got this coaster that my son gave to me. I'll hold it up to the camera so you guys can see it. On one side, it's got an ice cream sundae. On the other side, it's got beer, you know, beer in a sweaty glass with a nice head on top. I mean, you know, Don, don't that look attractive? You know, so if you're not salivating, you know, could be something wrong with you. Because I look at that and go, damn, you know, the advertising people sure did a good job on that one. You know, so my son gave me this coaster. He slid it across the table to me. And he goes, Dad, he goes, do you like ice cream or do you like beer? You know, at the time we were out having an ice cream dinner, you know, having an ice cream together, you know, so we called dude's time when my son and I, you know, just go out, him and I, you know, I said, well, buddy, we're out on dude's time, you know, just you and me, and we're eating ice cream. So, you know, I like ice cream. And I turned over the coaster to the beer side and I said, and Dad doesn't drink. So Dad doesn't like beer. My son was 5 years old at the time, you know, so he goes, but Dad, you do drink a lot. He goes, you drink a lot of coffee. When I was 5 years of age, if you asked me what my dad drank too much of, coffee would not have been the answer. You know, according to my mother, you know, when she joined Al-Anon, you know, she tells a story that, you know, she was told to sit down and tell the kids, you know, about alcoholism and about how the dad's a sick man, you know, and when she went to talk to us, she tells the story that I said to her, she goes, well, you know, there's something wrong with Dad. And I said, yeah, Dad drinks too much. And she looked, you know, she says that she looked at me and I said, well, don't you notice that during the day when Dad sees the dog, he pets the dog and he's really nice to him. But at night when he's drinking and the dog jumps up on the couch, he shoves him away and hits him. You know, so I guess even as a young kid, I could see alcoholic behavior. I could see the Jekyll and Hyde popping up. You know, so my son does not have to see that today. And the cool thing, like I said, my mom joined Al-Anon shortly before I was 8. And my son was 8, obviously, before he turned 9. He turned 9 last week. You know, so my son was 8 years old during the quarantine. So one of the things I took during the quarantine was I took about 15 minutes to explain to him why every night Dad's on the computer talking to people, you know, in different states. You know, why is it when my wife goes, where are you going tonight? And I say, oh, I'm going back to Kansas. You know, you know, my son's looking at me like, but you don't even leave the house. You know, so I explained to my son, you know, what meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous are and what they do for me. So what my son knows about Alcoholics Anonymous today is it's filled with men and women who want to get well, who want to not drink, and most importantly, want to have a relationship with God. You know, so my son knows today about the power of God and how we can show up in people's lives and can take them beyond, you know, where they were when they first met him. So when I celebrate anniversaries every year, you know, I always say that today's the annual celebration of the day that God got one of his kids back. You know, and that's what an anniversary is to me. And with that, I'll pass. Thanks for having me.